there are other ways for you to be critical as a person, as a citizen, as just a human being, because criticality is not something that is constricted to design practice.
So hello everyone, welcome to Travel Bubble, our podcast series about critical design practices. My name is Roxy and I'm very delighted to introduce you to our guest tonight, Afonso de Matos. For those of you who don't know Afonso already, I will briefly introduce him. Afonso is a graphic communication designer currently based in Lisbon. He graduated from the Faculty of Fine Arts in Lisbon in 2019, studied sound art for a year, and then enrolled in the Information Design Master's program at Design Academy Eindhoven, where he graduated this year with his master's project, Who Can Afford to Be Critical? Thank you so much for coming, Afonso.
Thank you, Roxy.
The long way
Thanks,
from
everyone.
Lisbon.
For being here. Super nice.
We'll be talking about criticality a lot tonight.
Yeah.
And it's also the theme of this podcast series.
Yeah.
So I would like to start with the question, how do you yourself define critical design?
Yeah, okay. You can start there. All right. So yeah, my whole project kind of has this keyword, critical. And this means, of course, many different things in many different contexts. But what I was trying to get at here in design context is to use critical design as kind of an umbrella term to wrap around a vast set of ways of working, but that have certain criteria in common. And I tried to also present those when I was talking about the project. And I also brought that memo here with me today, just because sometimes it's a bit tricky to remember all of them. But the whole idea, the whole basis idea is that you no longer, when you're talking about critical design, you're no longer talking about design just for the market or just as a service for, you know, profit of someone else. You're actually talking about reframing matters, posing new questions, maybe perhaps conceptualizing narratives. And those are also very vague words, which is something that we can talk about later, also the vagueness of it all in a way. The way we can sum it up is instead of solving problems, we pose new problems when we're talking about critical design. And then there's also this second criteria, which very much happens at least, and this was also coming from my context in Design Academy, which is that there's a very big focus on the designer's individual practice. So we're very much talking about what we can do individually as a designer. And even this word practice is a word that we use a lot in this kind of educational context, but it's also borrowed from contemporary art, the artist's practice, the individual genius that has specific ways of working. And that's something that we were always pushed to define very well, at least in Design Academy Eindhoven, to have your own very much individual stance, your individual way of working. And that's interesting because it gets into one of my favorite points to point out is that when you have a practice on, when you're talking about self-directing your own way of working, you're basically talking about undoing capitalism's division of labor, which was something that happened and basically divided the power to decide from the power to make. Inside the school, we have the power to decide what we're going to make, and then we make it. So it's amazing that we can do those things inside these kind of design schools. But outside, in the world outside, unfortunately, someone else high up decides what is going to be made, and then someone else, usually the designer, gets to just make. Basically, you have to abide to someone else's rule in order to pay rent, to have food on your table, to be paid in the end of the month. So that's another criteria. And then there's also this idea of designs for social good. So instead of just trying to present a product or profit or do something for profit, you are actually trying to involve yourself into political, environmental matters, social matters in a way. And that raises other questions about, that's of course super important, but are you trying to raise awareness about that? To whom are you speaking about, with which method are you using to speak about those things? And then the final one maybe is this idea of the power of design. So when we talk about critical design, we're talking about power, which is also the theme of this design-a-thon in a way. And at least in schools like Design Academy Eindhoven and many other design schools that are kind of embracing critical design, we're talking about design as power. We're going to get to that later as well, but we're talking about designers as powerful and design as powerful as well. And sometimes those things are a bit distinct. Saying that design is powerful doesn't necessarily mean that designers individually are powerful.
Yeah, but we're going
to get to that later.
That.
That's how I do, with these four criteria, I try to define what critical design is in a way.
Talking about the individual designer, I noticed that you yourself, you don't explicitly define yourself as a critical designer. At least I couldn't read it anywhere in your self-descriptions or in your bio. Would you say that you are a critical designer?
I think the whole thing with talking about critical design or talking about speculative design or social design or contextual design or whatever design is that sometimes these branches of design that are less tied to materiality or to a specific way of making, like product design or graphic design or, I don't know, fashion design, those are very much tied to ways of making, ways of producing that have certain traditions, which are way too traditional in a way. I'm not trying to defend those boxes. But when we get critical design or speculative design or contextual, whatever, all these nomenclatures, geodesign, sometimes we're talking about words that are used more as ways of identification and positioning, social and cultural positioning. So you're positioning yourself as a critical designer because that is differentiating yourself from your peers, which are just designers, just graphic designers. So you're positioning yourself as something higher than them. And that's not something that I'm trying to judge people for doing. It's something that I, during the thesis, I tried to understand why that was happening and why we were being not forced, but prompted socially and culturally in our field to try to be something more than what we already are. What are the socioeconomic forces behind it in a way?
Yeah, that's very interesting because I guess in a common understanding of critical design, design is no longer perceived as a profession or as a service, but as a powerful force to provoke change as well. But then in the end, in your opinion, what does critical design, what can it achieve in the real world, like outside of the design school, outside of these bubbles that exist?
Yeah, I mean, I would wonder if there is such a thing as critical design beyond those bubbles. That's how I would approach the question in a way, because it ends up being very much tied up to this way of working that is publicly funded, is based on, and very well so, publicly funded, as a certain system of research, grants and funding to support it, or comes from a certain kind of independent practice. But when you're talking about independent practice, where does the money come from? You sometimes have to add another part-time job, maybe in McDonald's or at a not-so-ethical work to fund your ethical or critical practice. Then how critical is it in the end? Are you ignoring the base socioeconomic conditions that underlie the fact that you can have this ethical position? Maybe your parents are supporting you in a way. Are your parents having an ethical or moral or critical occupation? So here we go into very specific articulations of hypocrisy and ambiguousness, and I'm not trying to deny them. On the contrary, we should stay with those hypocrisies and say, okay, it's fine. There's no such thing as like a pure critical moral position. We can never get to there because unfortunately we are bound by capitalism in the end.
Yeah, it's a very good point, I guess, because also being able to express criticality and critical design is always a matter of privilege and power, as you already mentioned. And in your master thesis, you point out the differences, and you mentioned it before as well, between the power of design and the power of the designer as an individual. And could you maybe elaborate a little bit more about this understanding of agency here?
Yeah, this was I was trying to get at it before. I think very much has to do with labor and the fact that we are not sometimes in these design schools that are talking about speculative or critical design, we are forsaking the dimension of work, the dimension of labor, the dimension that we have to actually unfortunately work to afford to live. And that's the basic condition of living under capitalism. So it's interesting when these schools function as safe havens for thinking about criticality and for thinking about critical design, I'm not necessarily criticizing the fact that inside of them we seem to have a lot of power and that they are giving us that power there. It's nice that we have that space for doing so. I'm just criticizing a bit the lack of realism or the lack of honesty or the fact that we don't look up front into that and that teachers tell us, okay, this is how it is. Beyond, it's not like that. And then it's not necessarily about accepting that the world is like that and that, oh, we should just work and forget about this criticality. It's about finding ways to do it, maybe not necessarily within your profession and within your work. There are other ways for you to be critical as a person, as a citizen, as just a human being, because criticality is not something that is constricted to design practice if you can't afford to do so in your job, in a way. And that's where the title comes in.
Exactly. So then let's talk a little bit about your major project, then, who can afford to be critical. It poses a lot of very important, very critical questions, also from within a design institution as Design Academy Eindhoven. Mm-hmm. And I guess you are also, as you just said, like criticizing these avant-garde design schools in a way. What did lead to your decision to start this discourse, mm-hmm. to think about these things and to talk to people about this question?
Yeah. You know, personally, I also come from a pretty okay position of privilege. Like, my parents were actually funding my studies, but many of my friends, they just didn't have that. And I was kind of radicalized by seeing them just have 2-3 part-time jobs to be able to afford being in school while they were doing that. Just constant conversations about labor, constant conversations about what are we doing here, and can we actually continue to do these kind of super cool critical design projects outside of school? And then also conversations about who actually gets to engage with these projects. What are they for? Are they only to be put up in biennales and museums and design weeks for a certain elite to engage with them? Or are they actually coming from a place of being invested in social work with communities for a long period of time? Because sometimes what happens is that you're just exploiting a certain struggle, and then you do a little design project about it that you did for like 3 or 4 or 6 months, and then that's it, and then you move on to the next project. And so also the kind of time-based frame that we very much are used to work with in design, which is based on projects that have certain timings, is not made to deal with actually social environmental questions. Those are not projects. They are lifelong matters that matter to you, and they go beyond your profession in a way. Yeah.
I want to jump into that question and ask you, like, who do you think, who is in the end engaging with those kind of projects? Who are the people who are reached by the kind of criticality that design can embody?
I think those kind of projects, they do have a place. They are super necessary and they're super important. So I'm also not trying to... My projects sometimes can have this reading of being reactionary or conservative. And I've had people come up to me in Design Week, in Dutch Design Week, and be like, yeah, I'm going to bring my daughter here and so she can see what's the real world and leave all this critical bullshit. And I'm like, no, that's not the point. That's not the idea. I'm just trying to bring some realism into it. But I think those projects, they can have certain awareness-raising power, of course. Of people that are not familiar with certain issues, they can approach those issues in a certain way, and design has that power to narrate those things. The problem I see a lot of times is that sometimes you're trying to impose your own, you know, artistry or aesthetic, you know, taste onto something and make it super nice looking and super complex because you like the aesthetics, but then it becomes completely incomprehensible for someone else to jump into it. And so there you can see kind of the design ego impose itself upon actually democratizing a certain issue.
I think what's also a very interesting question is, how did Design Academy Eindhoven, how did they react to your research as an institution? What happened?
You know, there are different levels to institutions, and that's also something that I kind of found out throughout the process. Of course, there are different levels, but for example, my tutors were very much on board with it, which was surprising at first, and that made me understand that they are sometimes closer to us in hierarchy than we think at the beginning, because sometimes, yeah, you're one step away from becoming them. And then when you go high up to the stable organogram, to the management, maybe those people weren't so pleased, but I'm not sure because I didn't talk to them. But there was this interesting thing in which at the end of the year, you have all these prizes and whatever. And I did get awarded some of those things. Like, I got the Cum Laude, the Reisbacher Award, the Best Thesis, whatever. Got those three things. But then also, like, talking with my tutors afterwards, I kind of understood that part of why they gave me that was because they were trying to weaponize my project as an information design department, weaponize my project to make a point regarding the higher-ups, because there was some restructuring happening in the course that they were not so happy about. also related to this kind of ways of seeing design in a way, but related to very shady management, very opaque management. And the guy who was leaving was basically trying to make a, I shouldn't be saying this actually in the publicly. Anyways, it's fine. They were weaponizing me in a way to also make a point against Joseph Grima. There, I said the name. there you go. No secrets anymore.
Yeah. Okay, this is huge. This is huge. How did that feel?
I'm fine. I felt okay being weaponized. I mean, I think part of it is also merit. I hope so. But then it's also interesting to see those inner institutional tensions at play and understand how people have different levels of power within an institution and how Design Academy was very much being driven by this one guy who has a creative vision. He has very nice ideas in the end, but it's also very much tied to the power of the designer and the power of design and what design can do. And he's never thinking about what design can't do and what are the constraints that bind their students in a way.
And if you could change, like, let's say, three key things in design education, like in general, like something that you missed or you feel like it's lacking of, what would it be?
I would bring some realism into it, yes. That's one thing. Two more. I wouldn't abandon. So I think this has different levels to it, because you can talk about design education that is very conservative and very traditional. And to those, I would bring a heavy dose of criticality. And we should actually be thinking about what we're making and not just blindly accept that we should serve the market and just be service designers in a way. But if you're talking about an institution that's already positioning itself as critical, I would bring the other element in and say, hey, maybe we should actually reconsider, who is this for? Are we just indulging in a bubble? What's the purpose of all of this, in a way? Can we afford to do this after the school? So I think there's different levels. And those are just two things.
That's
the third,
totally
you just make
fine.
It up afterwards.
Two is fine. You already talked about the design school as a very protected space where you all kind of speak the same language, you develop a certain set of vocabulary, yeah. You also have a very common visual language, I would say. Mm-hmm. It always happens. And then you enter the real world. And how do people manage to sustain critical practice outside of this? You already talked about it a little bit also about the financial issues. But can you maybe elaborate a bit more on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think for someone to engage in a kind of critical design practice, they always have to find other ways to finance themselves in a way, either by having a part-time job or another job in design that's maybe not so ethical or not so critical, or maybe teaching or doing something else that allows you to have that ethical, you know, position. And I think that's tricky for me, specifically when you're trying to not acknowledge that other part of yourself as if it's that, that's just underlying thing that doesn't have any importance. Because then you're just ignoring capitalism and you're ignoring the thing that you should actually be looking up front and saying, okay, this is the problem. This is why I can't just be critical one, like full time, which is the dream. And when we talk about this project, and then sometimes it might sound like I'm just saying, let's just be workers and designers should try to stop being critical and just do work and stop seeing design as this kind of ontological life force and just see design as labor. I think the end goal of it is that maybe we'd need to face that first in order to then understand that the real radical project is to question labor itself or work as a basis condition for human survival, for having to live in this earth, having to work. So ideally, we would all be doing critical or ethical design because that would be just it, what design is, in a world where work doesn't exist. But that's just another meta level beyond what we're here talking about. We can talk about that later also.
Yeah, maybe we're getting there someday. I want to jump back into the process of your graduate project. You were talking a lot to your peers and having like discussion groups with them, and it became, I think, an important component of this project and the process that you went through.
Yeah.
What did this process with them together look like? How did they feel about it?
Yeah.
Like talking about it, thinking about it? Mm-hmm. It must have been
interesting.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, there were many different, interesting points to it. At first, it was a bit hard to gather people. And I mean, at first, I had a lot of responses. I put posters all around school and people were just DMing me on Instagram saying, I want to participate. Then actually gathering those people and actually making a gathering and making it have any sort of juice in a way, anything interesting there, was a bit more complicated at the beginning. Specifically because I think when you get a big group of people, people start getting a bit uncomfortable and they're less leaning to share their opinions about something. I kind of discovered that a smaller group sometimes works best, like 10 to 15 people is fine. And then, yeah, people were very much on board with the kind of ideas that I was putting forward. And so it also felt like kind of a therapy session in a way. Everyone just shared, yeah, the school days and then, and there were also some other discussions that were a bit more debates about two different perspectives on design or what design should be. There were people that were more like me saying, we need to face that design is labor and that design is work, and that there were other people saying, no design, I don't care about design as a profession. We should try to commit to our values, whatever we are that we are doing, and just, you know, fuck rent, fuck, I don't know if I can say fuck. I think I can. We need to rethink paying rent, we need to rethink eating as a society, but what are the privileges that those rethinking processes also entail in a way? So those are very nice, interesting debates that happen also in the meetings. But they were nice. I liked them. It was very nice.
And you kind of like structured your project into three phases, I believe.
Four.
Right? Four. Okay, I forgot one. Can you maybe explain those four phases and like why did you decide to...
On those.
Yeah, to...
They kind of came out of the meetings in a way. So I organized a series of meetings, 5 or 6 meetings. And then from each meeting, I tried to have a specific theme for each one. So afterwards, I read all of the transcripts and I kind of identified key ideas that were coming from each moment of the meetings. And I organized those meetings in 4 different themes, which is the first about the school, the bubble of the school. The second about the power of design and the power of designers. What's the distinction between those two ideas? The third is kind of about what's the difference between saying that design is just a profession, just work, or that maybe it is something that is embedded into all human beings and all human beings are designers and we can all do design. So also those two different ideas. And then the fourth goes more into collective power. Instead of thinking that we have a lot of power individually, maybe can we think about power together? Not necessarily as designers, but as workers. So that was the fourth.
So then following the fourth phase,
yeah.
I want to ask about collectiveness.
Yeah.
Because I found it really interesting that you refer to collective strength as a powerful source. Would you say that you had personal experiences with this? Like,
yeah.
Did this come from your... personal
yeah
life.
I did have a collective before with and I do have still a collective with 2 friends of mine from the bachelor's, Inés and Serra. Big kisses to them, I love you. And we started working together doing freelance design, and it's just so much better doing something with 2 people by your side and actually feeling that you have that support system and not feeling the whole world kind of like crumble upon your shoulders and feeling the responsibility of having to respond to a client alone. So I think there's a great power in collectivity. And this is an example that is very much, you know, oriented towards just working very practically. But you can also talk about collectivity, of course, in political movements, which is where I think it's most expressive and most important to think about in a way. So yeah, that's kind of where it comes from. And yeah, it's important for me, that collective aspect in a way.
Yeah, very understandable. Okay, here comes the surprise question. So in the context of your graduate project, you developed a series of research-based t-shirts. And for those of us in the room now, you can expect one of them here later.
And one here.
And one here. Alfonso is wearing one of them. Actually, the one I want to talk about.
Okay.
So it shows 2 wolves.
Yes.
They're looking at each other. And the text goes, inside of me, there are 2 wolves. One is graduating from a critical design school. The other is unemployed. I love the t-shirt.
Am I laughing at my own joke? This is so embarrassing.
Not at all. Super t-shirt.
Okay.
So how are your inner wolves doing right now?
Oh, my inner wolves are great. They are employed. Yeah. Okay. I got a job, actually, guys. But it's not a critical design job. That's the thing. That's kind of, you know, what it was trying to highlight in a way. That maybe you study this critical design, you get into this super interesting practice, and then you have this punch in the stomach that's like, hey, forget about it, you gotta get a real job. And it's sad, of course, but it shouldn't demotivate you from trying to enact criticality. And that's kind of what I tried to take as the conclusion of this project, which is what I was already talking about earlier. Criticality is not something that we need to do as designers. We need to do it as people, as citizens. It's just something that's part of you as a human being. If it's part of you as a human being, it will, of course, transpire into your working ways, your ways of working. But you shouldn't feel frustrated if you find yourself sometimes in a position where you can't do that. Because if you just leave school and for economical reasons, you just have to get a super normal like design job at some corporate agency and you find yourself just doing branding all day long for Shell or whatever. Maybe you're at the end of the day, you're like, damn, I'm depressed. I hate this. Of course, like that's super understandable because work sucks. It's not necessarily that design sucks. It's work under capitalism that sucks. So you just have to kind of understand that your criticality and your ways of seeing the world that are, you know, close to your values as a person, they exist beyond your profession. You can still, ideally, we would have time beyond our jobs to care about those values, to work in ways that are dear to us, work in activism, close to associations, close to collectivities of people that are doing actually work from the ground up. Of course, it's also fine if you find ways to do it in your job. Like if you actually have those research fundings and grants and everything that allows you to have those critical design pieces at museums. I'm not saying that those things are not necessarily or not important. They have their place. It's just that when the discourse ends there and we think that's okay, I'm washing my hands, I've done my bit, then I think that gets problematic. So that's what I was pointing at.
So what's lining up for the future? Yeah. Like, are you planning to develop Who Can Afford to Be Critical further?
I don't know. It was a very heavy project to make kind of emotionally as well. It came from a place of me being very much fascinated with critical design before, with speculative design, and then getting to a point where these questions were just becoming unavoidable. So I had to face them up front and do a whole thesis about it. So it was very tasking. It was very intense. It was just basically, you know, kind of depressing in a way as well. So it was a hard year for me. So now I'm pretty happy to leave it as that and have people, like I made this little book, which you guys can see in a bit. And I'm also happy with that outcome. So for now, I think it's done. I would like to maybe push it forward, but in different ways, like working with these ideas of collectivity in Portugal somehow. Is it possible to unionize designers there? To think about ways to gather collective power there in some ways, but not necessarily Who Can Afford to Be Critical.
Fair enough. Well, thank you so much, Afonso, for being here tonight.
Thanks,
it
Roxy.
Was an absolute pleasure.
You're also great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Designathon. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thank you everyone for listening. Check out the previous episodes with Mayar and with Yuvi, and stay tuned for the next one, which will be in person next week, where Luna Fisher is interviewing Sherry Ann Davis. It will be very interesting as well. And if you in the room or the guys who are listening are interested in joining us at the Designathon and develop like formats or events, then please let us know and contact us through the email in the show notes. Thank you so much.